This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. You research your investments, right? You analyze markets, you manage risk. But did you research your broker? In 2025, IBKR clients outperformed the S&P 500. Retail clients averaged 19.2%, while hedge fund clients averaged 28.91% compared to the index's 17.9%. IBKR's lower trading costs, competitive rates, efficient execution, and access to more than 170 global markets helped investors keep more of what they earn and put more capital to work. Over time, the broker you choose makes a difference. Interactive Brokers, member SIPC. If you care about performance, find out why the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Go to IBKR.com/2025. Again, that's IBKR.com/2025.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Records are breaking. They're calling it Software Armageddon. Digging into the precious metals, what's going on there, and wake up, diversification fans. We have something for you. All this and much more on episode number 959 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to another great episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, I'm Andrew Horowitz. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor, and thank you for your efforts in becoming a disciplined investor. That's what we do here. We educate, we talk, we spend a lot of time on different parts of the market, things that are going on now and things that may be going on in the future. But all of it is meant to make sure that you have the tools and techniques to do what you need to do to get yourself to that level of financial security in the future that creates independence. You don't have to worry about things. You're not freaking out. We've all seen it, right? We've all seen where people have spent their lives too conservatively or too aggressively. And in the end, they're really in bad shape. What we want to do is be maybe somewhere in the middle of that. Now, there's nothing wrong with getting very wealthy. There is something wrong with making some very bad moves and missteps where your future is in peril, where you don't have enough money to even actually do what's right for yourself, to invest in a way that is, I guess, keeping ahead of inflation and keeping ahead of the cost of living in total, right? And inflation is just one part of it. The fact of the matter is that when we look at the overall amount of money that we need in the future, there is a lot to talk about of looking at what we're doing now to get there. What I mean by that is I talk about the future you and the present you. This is one of those cases when we want to start looking around for what we're doing and if things have changed enough to make some changes for our future. Right now, there's a lot going on in the markets that are really affecting things. It looks a lot worse from the outside than it actually does right now on the inside. A lot of times when I talk to you about there's only a certain handful of stocks that are leading things to the upside, what ends up happening is that markets look good. But of times we've talked about the sinkhole where that underneath the surface, it really isn't that good. However, right now, it's pretty much the opposite. And what I mean by that is that the things on the outside that were driving markets to new heights, the technology shares in particular, the software shares, the telecommunication, all of those are actually not doing so well. However, underneath all that, the other 400 stocks or the 380 stocks in the S&P 500 are actually doing fine. What they're calling right now is this Softwaremageddon, like Armageddon, but in reality, again, only certain areas of the market. Look, the S&P 500 Software and Services Index over the last, week or so is down like 13%. blowing out more than about $800 billion in market capitalization. And these are driven by just a few names, right? We're looking at companies like Intuit, ServiceNow, Oracle, which just cannot get ahead of itself. We are so happy that we sold them last quarter before this whole thing, or the quarter before that, I think it was, before all this happened. We got the quick up on the stock after that wonderful earnings announcement. Remember, the stock was up like 30% in one day. They had not only an earnings announcement, but a double whammy and benefiting them, where OpenAI said, you know, we're going to give them like $300 billion. And we were like, oh, what? Interesting. We like it. We like the stock action as owners of the stock. But at that moment, we were like, where's all this money coming from? It sounded much more like a hope to be than a reality. And that is what started the ball running in the wrong direction, where everybody started getting concerned about the spend. So relative to the overall S&P 500, the software group, that entirety of the software group, has now put in, listen to this, it's the worst three-month performance up until just this week since May of 2002. And that was during the major fallout of the dot-com bubble bursting, right? We know about that. And then we saw on top of that this whole, I don't even know what we're going to call it, from precious metals, but these areas that look like these monstrous moves, it did spread out a little bit, but generally speaking, up through, I would say, the mid part of the week, like Wednesday, it was really concentrated in some of the bigger names and the names that have been really taking it on the chin of late. Some of the risk, the super risk and high alpha names were getting hit. And then on top of that, it was the concern over certain software and what's going to go on in the financial, certain area of financial news, data gathering, legal. And that happened with an announcement by Anthropic, the AI company that came out with a legal tool, a tool to utilize in the legal profession, that they said, wait a minute, they're going to do it there. What about other professions? And then all of a sudden, many of the companies that were publicly traded in the area, which we knew about, that was collecting data and doing news on that collected data almost through a full AI experience, got smacked. I don't think there was any surprise there. But some of this AI situation is starting to roll over, and the excitement rolled over in a big way into things like gold and silver. And silver in particular, and many other precious metals that were deemed to be industrial use. And the case was made that, well, we can take silver and we can use it for chips and all these other things. I wrote a note to clients and kind of an internal piece partially. It was kind of a two-part piece because we try to put down a lot of times, and I've talked about this, right? That a goal, a resolution is nothing more than worth than the paper it's written on. But if you don't even write it to paper, it's not worth anything. But as long as you do write it at least to paper, it's kind of a commitment. It's a historical reference. It's something that you can say that I did flush out. And I wrote a piece on the wacky world of precious metals. And I started off with thinking, you know, if Shakespeare wrote The Merchant of Venice today, he probably would tweak one of the lines to say something like, instead of all that glitters is gold, to all that glitters is not gold or silver. But apparently all that glitters is gold until the Fed chair's news hits and it turns into lead overnight. I mean, the recent market action in precious metals, and let's not forget crypto, by the way, which we're seeing what's going on there, is nothing good. It's been brutal. And it appears that the catalyst, now whether or not this is the actual reason and rationale, but the catalyst was President Trump's nomination of Kevin Warsh to replace Jerome Powell as the Fed chair. Now this was announced when? Friday, right? The 30th of January. And I think the pick is being interpreted as a signal of a more hawkish Fed, which, by the way, is exactly opposite of what was going to be the case of the next pick. When we look at all the other names that were in the hat, whether it was Reeder or Hassett, Waller. These names were said to be, well, they're very dovish, and they'll be pushed around, and they want to reduce rates. But the idea now, the thinking is that Morse may be a little less aggressive with his rate cuts than many have been hoping for, and maybe that was plugged into the market analysis for what to expect over the next year or so. Which basically, what'd it do? It flipped the script, right? The script has said, okay, we have this going on. This is our narrative. This is our rationale. This is our reasoning. We think that rates will be lower. And with that in mind, what happens? Well, when rates are lower, valuations can be higher. We use a risk-free rate of return in calculating our terminal value of stock valuation. And when we do that, whether it's a dividend discount model or an earnings discount model, all that is much higher. Now, all of a sudden, Kevin Warsh enters the picture, which I have some thoughts on that, by the way. But the idea before he was appointed, at least at this point, was that markets are going to be running on easy money expectations. And add to that dynamic, this sell-off has also likely served as a convenient excuse for some profit-taking by the FOMO and MOMO crowd. Because these folks piled into assets during that parabolic move, and probably we saw that exhaustion gap that one day where gold moved up to like 117 or whatever it was an ounce. That parabolic move probably exhausted itself after months and months and months of relentless upside. So here's something to think about, because here's the headline that you want to kind of remember. This is something you want to embroider or burn into your head. January 30th, 2026. Yep. The date is now officially the worst single day for silver in modern history. I mean, silver just fell apart. COMEX futures on silver dropped about 31% on that day, settling in around $78, right? And that at one point in the day, it was even uglier. We're talking about a drop from the top to the bottom, about 35%, with prices dropping and dipping into the mid-70s. They retraced a bit and went back up, but then came back down again. And remember, this is coming literally days after silver blasted to record highs. Over $120 an ounce was that number. That was like, when I saw that, I'm like, oh man, if I've ever seen an exhaustion gap on a parabolic move, this is it. So that huge chunk of that parabolic move, gone, just like that. Wild move. There's no question there's some really cool things to watch here and learn from, because I had meetings. I think I mentioned this once before on the show. I had meetings with clients that were calling me about, what about silver? I'm like, listen, you're late. And if you own it, let's take some profits. I had clients call me about buying the stock of silver companies. I'm like, no, not right now, please. This is so extreme that the only possibility is for maybe a little more upside, but this downside to really kick in and reality to bite and get caught up in, for example, the silver stocks, which have been obliterated, by the way, since. Now, when we look at this particular market sell-off, when it comes to the precious metals, got to look at historical perspective for a moment, because this goes back to the legendary Silver Thursday. I don't know, maybe they could call this Silver Friday. I don't know. But when we look back to when this happened the last time at this extreme, it was considered Silver Thursday. It was March 27th, 1980. That was when the Hunt brothers, if you don't know about the Hunt brothers, they tried to corner the market, right? And things happened with margin and just had to bust out of everything. And that collapsed it. Silver fell around 33% during that key session, from about 16 and a quarter to $10.80 an ounce, with a multi-day panic loss of over 50%, because there's a lot of forced selling that went on, and just total chaos, just absolute chaos back then. Now, in the 1980 crash, it was systemic,
because it was marked and sparked by major regulatory changes. But futures data and coverage from most sources today show that the 2026 event now holds the record, bravo, for the single largest percentage decline ever. Wonderful. Not really. Pretty wild. And by the way, it wasn't just silver. Gold was down by 10%. Platinum crumbled by 19%. So, yeah, we're looking at this, right? With this trigger was probably kicked off by the early morning leaks and confirmation of Warsh's nomination. Yeah, it was leaked early in the morning. Things started getting a little wonky. The U.S. dollar was spiking, right? Which, if you look at dollar price metals, much greater cost for overseas buyers. But the real carnage came in the afternoon in the session late in the U.S. It was leverage again. That's what we have found out, at least. Leverage on Papa, leverage on these commodities. They piled into silver and gold during the recent mania, and what happened? They raced for the exits to lock in the profits, which then sparked cascading liquidations and margin calls and a classic overcrowded trade unwind. I mean, there's nothing new here, but why I want to talk about this and why I think it's extraordinarily relevant to the beginning of 2026 is this is a lesson that we need to not only learn, but master. We need to master this. If we're going to be disciplined and do the things that we need to do to get us in the right place in the future, we need to make sure that we don't get sucked in to either the upside run and hold or fall in love with something and hold through all of the pain. Now, gold also, as I mentioned, was getting hit roughly about 10 to 12% to the close. That was last Friday. It was clearly the wildest session in decades. Although gold didn't match silver's extreme. Bitcoin, which has also been a part of this whole debasement hedge crowd theme, is now down about, 30% from where it was just about 2 weeks ago. But in fairness, there still seemed to be some interest. After that big blow-off top, that exhaustion top, the gapping of a parabolic move that happened into a week and a half ago or so, we saw that drop happened, and about 2 days later, there was a big move. In fact, gold had the best 2 days in history, which is pretty amazing. Two-day run, bouncing back from the sell-off. Bottom line, markets are pinning this volatility squarely on the Fed Fed pick. And what it implies for future policy. Now, with that said, I want to talk about Warsh. I think it bears some flushing out of what I think of him. Before we do that, I want to talk for a second about Interactive Brokers again. Do you know? Here's a question. Do you know what's driving your portfolio's performance? Do you know that answer? Ask IBKR. Ask IBKR is a breakthrough AI-powered tool from Interactive Brokers that lets you interact with your portfolio using plain English. Ask a question and get an instant, data-driven answer about positions, risk, and returns. It's built right into the IBKR platform. Check it out at ibkr.com/ask, A-S-K, because the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. So what do I think? What do I think about Kevin Warsh? You want to know what I think? I actually think he's a solid choice. I'm a little bit of a deficit hawk. I think he is too, to a degree, or he has been in the past. And I think that's one of the things that's really haunting markets a little bit right now. I think he's much better than many other names that were being bantered around. I think most of them were just total kiss asses, brown nosers. They were trying to get a position by saying what they needed to say. And who knows, maybe President Trump saw all through that, realizing that we need an adult in the room, in the area of the Fed, not somebody that's just going to be a patsy, someone who would be easily pushed around and maybe even less independent. And Warsh has a real track record as a former Fed governor. And yeah, he has a reputation for being hawkish on inflation back in the day, and he pushed against over easy policy, criticized things like the bloated and crazy balance sheet numbers, the mission creep that we saw over the last, actually, probably during COVID was the greatest amount of mission creep, where they were working on, you know, DEI. Like, wait a minute, you're the money guys. Stay away from DEI. That's a whole different department. Now, even if he's aligned somewhat with calls for lower rates recently and to support growth amid, you know, even amid these productivity gains that we saw, I think, is my opinion, he comes across to me as someone who cares for and values the Fed's discipline, their independence, more than being a total yes man. And that's what I like about him. I think that's a real benefit. And this kind of person with a backbone, I would hope, can restore some credibility to the institution rather than turning it into a political tool. That's my hope. Yeah. But there's a question. Here's the thing. This black cloud that's potentially holding itself over all of this, and that is, does President Trump actually stick with Warsh if the market turbulence keeps up? Because you can picture the options, right? You know, does he stay the course, President Trump? Does he backpedal it a bit? Maybe he's going to reach out to, I don't know, a few allies in the Congress to gauge how rough the confirmation path may be. Or even more quietly, does he signal to senators that support him to just, you know what, pump the brakes? If things in the market stay squirrely like they are, maybe, you know what, let's not do this. Let's say I tried to put somebody in with a really good record, but in the end, they're not going to get appointed, so I got to come up with a second one, and maybe my second one now becomes Rick Reeder or back to Hassett again. We've seen this movie before. This isn't so far-fetched, and you know it. You know it! I mean, he's pivoted when markets threw tantrums over policy signals, bond yields spiking, equities getting whacked. You know, the whole thing, right? So I think it's not unreasonable to put forth the question of whether or not he sticks with the plan or does the market pressure nudge him in a different direction. So again, I think that Warsh really does bring a track record of discipline and independence to the table. And things that he's also talked about, I think, will bring a reset to Fred, to the Fed, their credibility, because that's been in question for a while. But the immediate action that we see, this action and reaction, shows, I guess, how pushed to the edge markets are and how sensitive prices have become to any hint of tighter monetary conditions. And look, from here, we're really going to have to keep a close eye on a few things. Of course, the confirmation hearings. That's something we'll have squarely in our view. Any little hint that comes out of the White House, we're going to have to watch. And of course, the dollar and metal flows. Because any one of those could bring a little clarity and settle things down, or they could light a fuse and continue this, you know, sell-off that may in fact start moving to other areas of the markets. As I said at the top, it's really been constrained to NASDAQ 100, some software, and some high beta. If you look at things like energy, hit an all-time high midweek last week, staples doing great, financials solid as can be, the value side of the equation is doing great. As a matter of fact, on the big sell-off, I think it was Wednesday I was looking, the equal-weighted S&P 500 was up 1% by the end of the day, up, equal-weighted, whereas the NASDAQ was down dramatically. It was about a 3% differential between the two. That is humongous. So because of all that's going on right now, the uncertainty, the chaos. Chaos has been the, I think 2026 dash chaos reigns. That's kind of, will sum up the whole year. But this is, honestly, this is exactly why we stay disciplined. The political, monetary, market feedback loops, they can get messy really fast, can't they? So rather than getting swept up in the hype or the headlines, you know what we do? We keep our footing. We stick to the process and let the noise simply burn itself out. What are you doing? You panicking? I will tell you that when we look at our portfolios going through all this, diversification has worked better than I can tell you. I was a little surprised part of this week. I'm like, how much is the market down and how much, what? Portfolios are what? They're not moving? Reason being, if you look at where we have our allocation and some of the things we have, that's true diversification. Now, does it hold you back sometimes in those market conditions that you just see a certain sector is moving up like we saw a couple of times over the last year or so where technology is flying and the rest of the market's doing okay? And it's like, okay, well, you know, all right. Well, in the end, it's the tortoise and the hare. They get to the same place at different speeds. One is, you know, coming in all scarred up and all messed up to the end, and one is just floating into the end very comfortably. But when we look at this, maybe there's a silver lining somewhere in all this mess of the metals. Probably, though, right after the margin calls are all cleaned up, right? That's going to be the issue. And while we're back on that subject, I want to talk to you about this because we talked about diversification for a moment here. And that's what we do for our clients, by the way. For those of you, by the way, that are really confused right now, I'm just going to stop here for a moment. If you're really confused about what to do moving forward in 2026, we're not. We have a good amount of clarity on where we go from here. And that sometimes is a very difficult task when you're looking too closely at the screen. You got to step back. But when also what we do is we have a different perspective on your portfolio than you have on your own. And that is why I say I don't cut my own hair. I've talked about this before. It's not because I don't have the physical ability to hold a scissor and cut my hair. That's not it. It's because the fact of the matter is that I can't have a proper perspective when I'm particularly cutting the back of my hair. I can't see it right. That being the case, I give those scissors to somebody else and they do a great job. Cost me a couple of dollars, but in the end, I look great. And I'd probably hack up the back of my hair here and there trying to make a little bit of a creative cut to the mess that I created. So with that in mind, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Let's take a look at your portfolio together, shall we? You have $500,000. That's where we start for our global allocations. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on one of the buttons that says either Ask Andrew or take a look at our TDI Managed Growth Strategy. That's a $50,000 minimum. Go over and check out what we are doing and ask me, Andrew, can you help me? I need a little clarity here. That's what we do for people. We've been doing this for four decades, my gosh. It's four decades already. And that's why we have some clients that have been with us pretty much the whole time. So check it out over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Now, why in all this mess that's going on now with precious metals and all this, why do we use precious metals and commodities inside of our global allocation strategies? Good question, huh? And let's explore for a minute why we own commodities and metals. Maybe a good way to start this is I think maybe why we don't own metals and what the reason is why we wouldn't own metals, I should say. And that's because we're not trying to call the next big move, right? We own them because they play a very real, very durable role in diversification. Precious metals, we got gold and silver. We have platinum, palladium. We have industrial material metals, copper, nickel, iron. You know, you go through the list of all the different things that are inside a commodity mixture. But these often tend to behave differently than stocks and bonds when the world gets messy. They react to different forces like currency shifts, inflation expectations. Even things like global liquidity, geopolitical surprises, all the things that we've seen recently. And while gold and silver did a stupid thing because investors got crazy, the long-term opportunity of being diversified for some of these things, inclusive of other commodities, oil, natural gas. Natural gas had a crazy move recently too. Things like foodstuffs. All the commodity structure provides us with the opportunity to build portfolios where we want exposures that don't all move in the same direction at the same time. And that's isn't that the whole point of diversification? That's it in a nutshell right there. And that's specifically where commodities come in. Because commodities aren't just this, I don't know, this shiny object or just energy contracts. They're actually real assets. You can hold them. They respond to supply and demand in the physical world. And when inflation, things like that heat up, when the dollar moves, when there's geopolitical uncertainty, the commodities often give us this countering, right? Counterbalance is a good way to look at it. Better than traditional financial assets. So inside of our global allocation strategy, we carve out a slice that we commit to this. Not a massive piece, but a meaningful one. Even when you get a situation where markets start throwing curveballs, as they always do, by the way, we look at this as something in the portfolio that behaves differently. Yes, I know they've behaved really differently lately, and that was the first whole part of this discussion we had of why silver went parabolic and the FOMO crowd, the idea that the debasement trade was huge, the dollar was going to come down, geopolitical issues, wars, taking over Greenland, blah, 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 blah. We know that, right? But when we look at this and we look at the idea of how does a commodity position, a proper commodity position, which we're going to get to also, do not turn this off till you hear what I'm going to talk about that. A proper commodity positioning adds incredible value. We see this historically because we can see this when we have all these bouts of monetary shifts and currency volatility. Commodities have often been one of the areas that stay resilient or even outperform other parts of the markets that are struggling. We had that situation in the last quarter into the first month or so this year. It was dramatic. So when we ask ourselves in the investment committee that we have regularly discussing, why do we own this stuff? The answer is kind of simple. Because a well-built portfolio, when you look at how a constructed portfolio that is built upon bases and layers of diversification, that is not built because we're predicting the next headline. Nope. It's built and crafted to prepare for a wide range of outcomes that we're not exactly certain of over the next, let's say, year or two. And when you look at commodities and precious metals and industrial metals, they do exactly that. They give the portfolio another gear, another tool inside the portfolio so that we're not so dependent on just stocks and bonds to carry the load. Now, commodities are separate from alternatives. I've talked about alternatives many times. Why you want to have alternatives inside the portfolio. And alternatives, you know, we talked about things like, you know, buying whiskey barrels. We talked about things like, you know, utilizing fund-to-funds management, even things like, dare I say, cryptocurrencies, things that are not aligned. Although cryptocurrencies, I think, just nailed themselves to the wall with the latest move that was aligned too closely with the NASDAQ due to leverage and the speculative nature of the of the actual asset rather than all this other stuff that's been not only told to us, but forced down our throats and inside our ears and poked our eyes out over the last number of years that, you know, cryptocurrency is a store of value and a diversification factor. Bullshit. No. I don't think so. And I've talked about that since the beginning. I have not changed my story. I don't think I've wavered at all on my idea that that three-legged stool that was originally being presented as a store of value, a transaction mechanism, and a speculative asset was nothing more than the one leg of a speculative asset. That's all it is. There was a study done, I think, last week or last week before that, that talked about like 85 or 90% of all the cryptocurrencies that ever been created have been fraudulent scams or some other rug pull that was being done. The other like 8, 9% are questionable, and there's maybe 1% of the entirety of all cryptocurrencies that were created that maybe have some reasonable amount of stability and opportunity in the future. So when we talk about real diversification, that's what it looks like, right? We have all these different positions that are layered upon each, but at the same time, it's like a fine dish. You don't just throw salt on and pepper on and all this. You layer on flavor to come up with a very nice composed dish that is delicious. A lot of people just throw salt. They just throw pepper into something and hopefully it tastes good. And they realize, my God, it's overcooked and it's rotten tasting. If you want to create something that is true diversification and layer on all these different components for a well thought out and a well established portfolio, that is where this comes in. But not, here's the point I was making where I said, don't go anywhere. Not just any commodity investment. And this is really important. Because I'll tell you a little secret. We struggled with this for years. Because a lot of people use simple commodity benchmarking, like, I don't know, 60% oil and other kinds of energy, and 20% foods, 20% metals, or they look at like the Bloomberg commodity benchmark or some other benchmark as a way to get exposure. Most mutual funds, they just that are commodity based, are just mimicking a particular index as their benchmark and rotating and doing things, and they're buying future contracts. A lot of times they're doing it through what's called backwardation or contango and the wrong timing of it. And this is not the way that we, in our modern portfolios here, gain exposure to commodities. Nope. Now, it took us a long time to find this out. And commodities generally worked well and okay for what they were supposed to be for a long time. But there was limitations. And those limitations always, always gave me a thorn in the side. And we spent a lot of time thinking about the best way to go about this. And what we found is it takes a much different approach and a management strategy inside the commodities. Inside that portfolio strategy to actually make a commodity exposure that works. I don't know how to tell you this, but not all commodity exposure, whether it's just a plain ETF or all, is a good idea for a portfolio just to say, I got commodity exposure. I'm happy. Thank you very much. Okay? That's not how it is. So let's break it down a little bit on how we actually invest in commodities which inside these diversified portfolios. What we look for and what we have now is a strategy that isn't just simply buying a basket of currency, commodities, foodstuffs, energy, blah, 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 right? Nope. Instead, what we have worked on is finding a manager and managers that have a smart adaptive system that basically studies the commodity market every month and decides which area looks the strongest. Or said another way too, it's what has the best value. So the main theme, for example, that we found with how we invest in commodities is that the belief that commodities with low inventories, lower supply are going to outperform commodities with a higher supply and a price that's base measured using what's called backwardation and contango. So what's the difference? Why does it occur? So futures typically are used inside the commodity space, right? And what happens is contango is the usual setup for commodities and futures. It's when the price is higher in the later months for expiration. So what you do is you buy the later month and you sell, and it kind of loses value. Just what unless something really moves in the market. So the future expiration curve is sloping up. You're going to roll what's called rolling your risk into the future. So that's generally how things go. You have the cost of storage, you have financing cost, another carrying cost. This is all built into the commodity. And what happens is you continually roll this over time. And that's what most of these regular benchmarked commodity funds, ETFs do. And it's very difficult to make money because one, they don't change their positioning. Two, they're buying in contango. However, what we like is looking where there's value. And what is that? Backwardation. Backwardation is when the price is lower in later expiring months. The futures curve is sloping down. We think so what do? So we buy at a lower price. It indicates the higher near-term demand or supply constraints. Consumers are willing to pay more for the product now than the future. And if that keeps on running, what happens is the exact opposite of a contango. I get the benefit of a value trade on my commodities. Okay. So now, the investment that we like, there's about 27 different commodities out there, right? Big universe. There's energy, metals, grains, livestock, all this stuff that we talk about, the usual suspects. Okay, great. Each month, what happens is they rotate with 14 of the most attractive based on real world signals like pricing trends, sign of tight supply, strong demand. Now, I'm going to try to explain something to you. I want you to just take a moment, take a breath. I want you to envision what I'm about to tell you. Think about oil for a second. It goes up between, I'm just going to pick some numbers, $50 and $70, $50 and $70. Over time, it goes up, it goes down, it goes up. Maybe it goes to 90, comes back to 70. But the higher the price of oil, the less use it's going to be for people. In other words, when the price of a commodity goes up too high, it naturally fixes itself and brings down the price because no one can afford it. Now, if I was to invest only in oil, and that was my hold, in a contango circumstance, I'm going to lose money on the rolls. And how do I actually make money? If I am going to be in a fixed position of 40% oil in the portfolio, and it ranges from 40 to 50 to 90 to 50 to... it has a range. And unless I'm doing some market timing that is extraordinaire, how am I going to really make money? Over time, maybe a year, 2 years, yes. But what happens over a 5-year period? Really going to make 3-5% a year. Whereas if I take a different strategy, rather than owning the physical commodities, right? I use these futures contracts. And I look for the most attractive based on real world signals. Well, what happens? I'm in and out. Oil goes to 50 to 80, maybe I'm out. Rotated into wheat. That looks like it's a better value. I don't have to hold that large position that is benchmarked because that's what my description, my strategy says I have to do. Cool. Now, inside of this positioning, you got these future contracts. And to support the future contracts, you got money sitting in things like short-term U.S. government securities or treasuries, cash equivalents. That's what's called collateral. And here's the thing. The very specific vehicle that we use for commodities rebalances each and every month. So if copper suddenly looks weak and, I don't know, natural gas is strong, it shifts. If your agriculture gets too hot, energy cools off, it adjusts. It's always trying to rotate, right? Just trying to find where the value is in the commodity universe. Now, is that better than benchmarking? Yeah. How do you find the management like that? It takes a lot of work. But we utilize that inside of our global allocations and decided that we know that when you do the math, looking back decades and decades of how it is that actually commodities work within a diversified portfolio that is asset allocated using things like mean variance optimization. You know, we're looking at various curves. We're looking at the efficient frontier. We're looking at things that were created by the masters, whether it was Sharpe, you know, any of the major players that created modern day asset allocation and the tools to truly try to get optimized diversification, not just flinging stuff into a portfolio. I'm talking about optimized diversification. Whereas while I talked about this before, you've heard me say it, the flower garden, while hoping to have your flower garden in total bloom at all times, the reality is that seasons change. And as seasons change, what happens? Those impatiens die off. Roses no longer. The annuals, they come up, they go down. What's left? Well, what's left is evergreens and maybe some tree trunks in the harshest of winters, but at least you got the evergreen. That's fine. That's like our money market, our treasuries, our safety valves, the buffers in a portfolio. You don't want to have only impatiens or roses. They die off in the winter, but other things bloom. So why not have those as well? So in our flower garden, something is blooming at any given time, and that is exactly how you want to design a portfolio. But you also want to have the best flowers. You want to have the best species inside of your garden, just like you want to have the best opportunity, not just a simple, I'll pick this as a stock fund. No, you want to have low cost. You want to have great management tenure. You want to have things like risk-adjusted performance that is sharp. You want to have and make sure that there's not a lot of overlap in your portfolios. There's a whole litany of things you want to make sure, but all those, and of course, you want to have good historical performance against not only benchmarks, but peers in a like category. All those things combine. All those things are essential. Any misstep you make can poison the rest of your portfolio. And you know what? You've probably seen this in yours. Not only that, what about when you just hold on too long? When you're like, you know, it's down so much, I can't get rid of it now. Really? Are you telling me can't go any lower? Is that what you're saying to me? No. Well, what are you saying? Well, I'm saying that I don't want to sell it because I'll take a loss. Well, where's the money better, in that position or in another? Well, probably another, but I don't want to take the loss. Well, not a good way to do business. Not a good way to manage your portfolio. Back to the perspective discussion and the haircut. So we're talking haircuts. We're talking about flower gardens. We're talking about diversification. We're talking about strategy. We're talking about how to make sure that your portfolio is set, especially in times like this where we see a lot of volatility, a lot more volatility than many were expecting, hoping for, thinking about. The fact of the matter is when we see markets selling off dramatically, you know, like they had been doing, but really focused on a few areas in particular, we got to start thinking about where's the opportunity now? Where are we going? Where are we making mistakes? Where should we be diversifying better? So all these things go into the idea of making sure that there is a significant balance, you're making good decisions, and you're looking to go where the strength is, avoid where the weakness is, and keep adjusting as markets change, right? The whole strategy that you should be employing is dynamic, rules-based, and constantly adapting to what's happening around the world. That's not every day. That's not every minute. But what you want to do is make sure that you are at least set and you know where you're going. A trip without a map will get you nowhere. Trying to reach the horizon is an impossible task. Somewhere in between that of knowing where your goal is and having a map to get there is exactly what a disciplined investor does. Exactly. So I hope you take that to mind. I hope you take that and really that sinks in, that works for you and gives you a lot of perspective and think and something to chew on over the next week. Head over to disciplineinvestor.com. Let me know what you think. I want to know what you think. I want to know what you think. Hit the Ask Andrew button, comment, tell me what you think about the show this week and generally speaking, every week. We have a great guest coming up next week, Cullen Roche. He's got a great book out, The Perfect Portfolio. He's a great author. Make sure that you are subscribed. Go to Apple, go to Spotify, go to Amazon Music, go anywhere that's where you'll find us. Make sure you subscribe so you get it right when it hits each and every Sunday, The Disciplined Investor. Of course, you can listen to DH Unplugged as well, which is Tuesdays, myself and John C. Dvorak. We rack it up pretty good. That's a fun show. I enjoy that every week. But for now, thank you for joining me this week and every week, and I'll see you again real soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.